This podcast is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, award-winning wealth managers who go above and beyond to support and guide you. Visit candowealth.com to start building your wealth with confidence.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Isabel Hardman. Over the weekend, we finally heard from a former political figure who had been rather quiet of late, despite repeated attempts by journalists to get in touch with them. This is David Cameron, the former Prime Minister, following a series of allegations over the Greensill saga. Isabel, David Cameron's put out a statement after news stories over the weekend suggesting he had a drink with Matt Hancock when it came to trying to procure help for Greensill. What did he have to say?
So he has issued a statement saying, "I've reflected on this at length. There are important lessons to be learned. As a former Prime Minister, I accept that communications with government need to be done through only the most formal of channels, so there can be no room for misinterpretation." So he's not saying he's done anything wrong. He's just saying that things could have been misinterpreted because the system has allowed them to be misinterpreted, and he thinks those things should change. I was quite interested by the timing of this statement. So you could say that there's been quite a few other things, namely one other dominant thing on the news agenda that may have made Cameron's statement a little less highly in the news agenda. Also, I think that things had reached a stage where all of the newspapers were feasting on this. And when you've got all the newspapers competing for the next new line on a scandal, that's when you know it's not going to go away and you need to do something to stop the flames going ever higher. Now, I'm not sure whether what he said is going to stop the flames going ever higher, if I'm honest, because it is something, firstly, that he's allowed to grow as a row for what is sort of 6 weeks now, isn't it? It's quite a long time that he's 30 days it's taken him to respond to this. But also that there are a lot of grey areas here, and his communications with the Treasury in particular are ones that he may have to answer in greater detail.
Yes, I think it's interesting his comment about lessons learned. It almost sounds like something that would come from a third party, not the person at the centre of all the allegations. It felt as though he was going to need to say something because it's become more serious. But yet, as far as I can tell, Isabel, we don't have anything in terms of what was actually in the messages he sent to the Chancellor and other figures. He hasn't come forward with any of that information. So we're only really having a one-sided, I suppose, evidence so far in the fact that Rishi Sunak released his. Do you think that David Cameron's going to come under pressure to give more in terms of what exactly was said and when now?
Yeah, well, if you talk to people who do crisis comms, they'll often say that one of the best ways to deal with these things is to respond early, which obviously hasn't happened, but also to get all the information out there, because what journalists love is the sense that there's more to find and that they're not being given the whole story. And I think, as you say, and as I just said, that we haven't been given the full story here, that there are missing bits. And so that leaves a lot of journalists who are like dogs with bones continuing to worry those bones.
And I think it's raised lots of questions in the sense that David Cameron clearly believes that he did not break any rules, any laws when it comes to lobbying. But I think that's led to quite a widespread prompt to say, are the rules fit for purpose? We've had Gordon Brown out and about today, and he's been suggesting a solution to this, which is a 5-year, perhaps cooling off period in which a former prime minister cannot engage in any lobbying activities. Do you think that's likely to win much support from former prime ministers or would-be former prime ministers when they think about their outside earnings?
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky because each ex-prime minister has a slightly different vision for their life. And I think it's fair to say that Gordon Brown's vision for his post-Number 10 life was very different to Tony Blair's and to David Cameron's. Although I think David Cameron's work has surprised some people, given the amount of energy he expended talking about the importance of public service after holding high office and that sort of thing, that actually there is some of the sort of Tony Blair desire to earn lots of money out of office as well. I suppose one does have to finance shepherd's huts somehow. But there are lots of suggestions during the rounds. You have Bernard Jenkin as well, who as the Select Committee Chair of the Committee on the Civil Service and Standards in Public Life and so on, has been making suggestions for years. And in fact, I remember Cameron and Jenkin having a very awkward standoff in one of the liaison committee hearings a few years ago. Now, that was on the civil service reform plan that Bernard Jenkin had. But I think it's fair to say that when Bernard Jenkin was making suggestions on the revolving door of people going out of government and out of the highest offices in particular, Cameron probably wasn't taking them as seriously as he might be doing now.
Now, in other news, we have a latest stage in the easing of the government's roadmap for ending the lockdown. We're entering al fresco Britain. I think this is what the period will be known as, even if it did begin with some snow this morning. Isabel, many things are opening up. I mean, we hear the Prime Minister is getting a haircut this morning ahead of the debate this afternoon in the Commons on Prince Philip. We also have al fresco hospitality, the options in terms of self-catering, accommodation, you can go to the gym. What is the general sense right now in terms of how the roadmap is unfolding? Do you think that MPs believe it's going to stay on course, even if it's not going to be sped up? Because we're now starting to hear warnings from scientists at the weekend that the switch they're more worried about is not this one, which is mainly outdoor, but actually the next one, whereby which in May you'd be allowed to be indoors.
Yeah, I think if you talk to a lot of Conservative MPs, that they accept that the roadmap isn't going to be sped up, but what they don't accept is that it's likely to stay as it is and not slip back. And that's partly because they just don't trust the word of ministers anymore. They don't trust the motives and the sort of focus and attention of Boris Johnson and Matt Hancock. They basically think that both of them have been captured by the scientists, as they'd say. You can make of that what you will, but they think that these men in particular have become far too cautious, and that of course infection rates are going to go up when people start meeting indoors. But the promise that was always held out to these MPs and to the public was that when these restrictions lift, it will be when the majority of people have been vaccinated. And certainly the argument that's being made by a lot of people, not just in the sort of lockdown sceptic wing of the Conservative Party, but more widely, is, well, we have vaccinated pretty much all of the vulnerable groups now, and it's just a case of the second vaccinations and of chasing down the very hard to reach people. Although you could say that looking at the take up of the vaccine in care homes suggests that there is some way to go in terms of those who look after vulnerable people. But there's an impatience now, which is, well, we've got this vaccine programme, we're doing really well, you keep boasting about how well this vaccine programme's going, so why are you now saying that the timetable could slip again? I think there's also today there's a lot of interest in how the economy will respond to the lifting of these restrictions, particularly how the high street will recover or change over the next few months. So we've got a lot of shops that have been just about hanging on, which are reopening and are hoping, and this is certainly the hope of those in the Treasury as well, that there is a lot of pent-up demand from consumers who actually haven't lost that much money, or indeed, I think the Treasury estimate is that many families have saved around £7,000 this year, that those families are going to go out and spend on the high street, and when they're allowed to, book holidays and obviously get all their hair cut off and celebrate the reopening. And there is a lot of interest in whether that's going to be enough to save the high street, and what does saving the high street look like when the high street was already in terrible decline before this pandemic.
And as you touched on in terms of those comparisons of other countries, I think what's going to be really interesting is there's been a huge focus on Israel. Whenever you speak to anyone in government, they say, well, look to what Israel's doing. And it does seem as though we are a few months behind in terms of the debates they're having there. So now, obviously, we're in the midst of one of vaccine passports, child vaccination, also something that's been in Israel, we're now beginning to talk about here, slightly dented by, I think, the blood clot risk bringing in, which might mean it isn't doesn't progress in the same way now. But I wonder now, with countries like America opening up after vaccinating, but not in the vaccinating every single person, even if everyone is offered, that could actually increase pressure on the UK government when it comes to these various reviews on what life on June 21st looks like. Because I think, if you have more than one successful model to choose from, I think that will increase pressure on number 10. Back when we were looking, I think in the summer, at Sweden, and lots of Tory MPs started citing the Swedish example, saying, well, look, they haven't had a lockdown and now they have incredibly low rates, lower than lots of these places that have locked down, that really put pressure on number 10. Now, the rates in Sweden went up considerably after that, which I think meant that it was easier for number 10 to argue its case on the way forward. But I think the America element is definitely one to watch on.
And we've obviously got the Moderna vaccine coming online as well now. It started its rollout in Wales, and this is the sort of great white hope for younger people, given the blood clot risk, the extremely rare blood clot risk that the AstraZeneca vaccine has. That that vaccine will now largely take the place of AstraZeneca, while people are also being offered Pfizer in some places as well. So I guess one of the other stories that's going to be prominent still over the next few weeks is the impact of the AstraZeneca change in policy on the vaccine programme and on young people getting vaccinated in particular.
Thank you, Isabel, and thank you for listening.